Hey, what's up, everybody? We now finally have the long-awaited Chapter 14 audio version for the AP American Pageant Textbook. Here we go. 14, Forging the National Economy, from 1790 to 1860. The new nation went bounding into the 19th century in a burst of movement. New England Yankees, Pennsylvania farmers, and southern Yemen all pushed west in search of cheap land and prodigious opportunity, soon to be joined by vast numbers of immigrants from Europe, who also made their way to the country's fast-growing cities. But not only people were in motion. Newly invented machinery quickened the cultivation of crops and the manufacturing of goods, while workers found themselves laboring under new, more demanding expectations for their pace of work. Better roads, faster steamboats, farther-reaching canals, and tentacle-stretching railroads all helped move people, raw materials, and manufactured goods from coast to coast, engulfed the Great Lakes by the mid-19th century. The momentum gave rise to a more dynamic, market-oriented national economy. The Westward Movement. The rise of Andrew Jackson, the first president from beyond the Appalachian Mountains, exemplified the inexorable westward march of the American people. The West, with its raw frontier, was the most typically American part of America. As Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote in 1844, Europe stretches to the Alleghenies. America lies beyond. The Republic was young, and so were the people. As late as 1850, half of Americans were under the age of 30. They were also restless and energetic, seemingly always on the move and always westward. One tall tale of the frontier described chickens that voluntarily crossed their legs every spring, waiting to be tied for the annual move west. By 1840, the demographic center of the American population map had crossed the Alleghenies. On the eve of the Civil War, it had marched across the Ohio River. Legend portrays an army of muscular axemen triumphantly carving out civilization out of the western woods, but in reality, life was downright grim for most pioneering families. Poorly fed, ill-clad, housed in hastily erected shanties, Abraham Lincoln's family lived a year in a three-sided lean-to made of bush and sticks. They were perpetual victims of disease, depression, and premature death. Above all, unbearable loneliness haunted them, especially the women, who were often cut off from human contact, even their neighbors, for days or even weeks, while confined to the cramped orbit of a dark cabin in a secluded clearing. Breakdowns and even madness were all too frequently the opportunities that the frontier offered pioneer women. Frontier life could be tough and crude for men as well. No-holds-bar wrestling, which permitted such niceties as the biting off of noses and the gouging out of eyes, was a popular entertainment. Pioneering Americans, marooned by geography, were often ill-informed, superstitious, provincial, and fiercely individualistic. Ralph Waldo Emerson's popular lecture essay, Self-Reliance, struck a deeply responsive chord. Popular literature of the period abounded with portraits of unique, isolated figures, like James Fenimore Cooper's heroic Natty Bumppo and Herman Melville's restless Captain Ahab, just as Jacksonian politics aimed to emancipate the lone wolf, enterprising business person. Yet even in this heyday of rugged individualism, there were important exceptions. Pioneers, in tasks clearly beyond their own individual resources, would call upon their neighbors for log rolling and barn raising, and upon their governments for help in building internal improvements. Shaping the Western landscape. The Westward Movement also molded the physical environment. Pioneers in a hurry often exhausted the land and the tobacco regions and then pushed on, leaving behind barren and rain-gutted fields. In the Kentucky bottomlands, cane as high as 15 feet posed a seemingly insurmountable barrier to the plow. But settlers soon discovered that when the cane was burned off, European bluegrass thrived in the charred cane fields. Kentucky bluegrass, as it was sometimes inaccurately called, made ideal pastures for livestock and lured thousands more Americans as homesteaders into Kentucky. The American West felt the pressure of civilization in additional ways. By the 1820s, American fur trappers were settling in their trap lines all over the vast Rocky Mountain region. The fur trapping empire was based on the rendezvous system. Each summer, traders ventured from St. Louis to verdant Rocky Mountain Valley, made camp, and waited for the trappers and Indians to arrive with their beaver pelts to swap for manufactured goods from the East. This trade thrived for some two decades. By the time beaver hats had gone out of fashion, the hapless beaver had all but disappeared from the region. Trade in buffalo robes also flourished, leading eventually to the virtually total annihilation of a massive bison herd that once blanketed the western prairies. Still farther west on the California coast, other traders bought up prodigious quantities of sea otter pelts, driving the once bountiful otters to the point of near extinction. Some historians have called this aggressive and often heedless exploitation of the West's natural bounty ecological imperialism. quick note, imperialism, vocab word, imperialism is when one power kind of dominates and takes over and exploits another region. They're saying, in this case, ecological imperialism is humans' imperialism or dominance and exploitation of the nature. Yet Americans in this period also revered nature and admired its beauty. Indeed, the spirit of nationalism fed the growing appreciation of the uniqueness of the American wilderness. Searching for the United States' distinctive characteristics in this nation-conscious age, many observers found the wild, unspoiled character of the land, especially in the West, to be among the young nation's defining attributes. Other countries might have impressive mountains or sparkling rivers, but none had the pristine, natural beauty of America, unspoiled by human hands and reminiscent of a time before the dawn of civilization. This attitude towards wilderness became, in time, a kind of national mystique, inspiring literature and painting, and even kindling a powerful conservation movement. George Catlin, a painter and student of Native American life, was among the first Americans to advocate preservation of nature as a deliberate national policy. In 1832, he observed Sioux Indians in South Dakota recklessly slaughtering buffalo in order to trade the animals' tongues for the white man's whiskey. Appalled at the spectacle and fearing the preservation of Indian and buffalo alike, Catlin proposed the creation of a national park. His idea later bore fruit with the creation of a national park system beginning with the Yellowstone Park in 1872. The March of the Millions. As the American people moved west, they also multiplied at an amazing rate. By mid-century, the population was still doubling approximately every 25 years, as in fertile colonial days. By 1860, the original 13 states had more than doubled in number. 33 stars graced the American flag. The United States was fourth most populous nation in the Western world, exceeded only by three European countries, Russia, France, and Austria. Urban growth continued explosively. In 1790, there had been only two American cities that could boast populations of 20,000 or more, Philadelphia and New York. By 1860, there were 43, and about 300 other places claimed over 5,000 inhabitants apiece. New York was the metropolis. New Orleans, the queen of the South, and Chicago, the swaggering lord of the Midwest, destined to be the hog butcher for the world. Such over-rapid urbanization unfortunately brought undesirable byproducts. It intensified the problems of smelly slums, feeble street lighting, inadequate policing, impure water, foul sewage, ravenous rats, and improper garbage disposal. Hogs poked their scavenging snouts about many city streets as late as the 1840s. Boston in 1823 pioneered a sewer system, and New York in 1842 abandoned wells and cisterns for a piped-in water supply. The city thus unknowingly eliminated the breeding places of many disease-carrying mosquitoes. A continuing high birth rate accounted for most of the increased population, but by the 1840s, the tides of immigration were adding hundreds of thousands more. Before this decade, immigrants had been flowing in at a rate of 60,000 a year, but suddenly the influx tripled in the 1840s and then quadrupled in the 1850s. During these two feverish decades, over 1.5 million Irish and nearly as many Germans swarmed down the gangplanks. Why did they come? The immigrants came partly because Europe seemed to be running out of room. The population of the Old World more than doubled in the 19th century, and Europe began to generate a seething pool of apparently surplus people. They were displaced and footloose from their homelands before they felt the tug of the American magnet. Indeed, at least as many people moved within Europe as across the Atlantic. America benefited from these people-turning changes, but did not set them all in motion. Nor was the United States the sole beneficiary of the process. Of the nearly 60 million people who abandoned Europe in the century after 1840, about 25 million went somewhere other than the United States. Yet America still beckoned most strongly to the struggling masses of Europe, and the majority of migrants headed for the land of freedom and opportunity. There was freedom from aristocratic caste and state church. There was abundant opportunity to secure broad acres and better one's condition. Much read letters sent home by immigrants, America letters, often described in glowing terms the richer life, low taxes, no compulsory military service, and, quote, three meat meals a day. The introduction of transoceanic steamships also meant that the immigrants could come speedily in a matter of 10 or 12 days instead of 10 or 12 weeks. On board, they were still jammed into unsanitary quarters, thus suffering an appalling death rate from infectious diseases. But the nightmare was more endurable because it was shorter. The Emerald Isle moves west. Ireland, already groaning under the heavy hand of British overlords, was prostrated in the mid-1840s. A terrible rot attacked the potato crop, on which the people had become dangerously dependent, and about one-fourth of them were swept away by disease and hunger. Starved bodies were found dead by the roadsides with grass in their mouths. All told, about 2 million perished. Tens of thousands of destitute souls fleeing the land of famine for the land of plenty, flocked to America in the, quote, Black '40s. Ireland's great export had been the population, and the Irish take their place beside the Jews and the Africans as a dispersed people. These uprooted newcomers, too poor to move west and buy the necessary land, livestock, and equipment, swarmed into the larger seaborne cities. Noteworthy were Boston and particularly New York, which rapidly became the largest Irish city in the world. Before many decades had passed, more people of Hibernian blood lived in America than on the old sod of Erin's Isle. The luckless Irish immigrants received no red carpet treatment. Forced to live in squalor, they were rudely crammed into already vile slums. They were scorned by the older American stock, especially, quote, proper Protestant Bostonians, who regarded the scruffy Catholic arrivals as a social menace. Barely literate biddies, Bridgets, took jobs as kitchen maids. Broad-shouldered Patties, Patricks, were pushed into pick-and-shovel drudgery on canals and railroads, where thousands left their bones as victims of disease and accidental explosion. It was said that an Irishman lay buried under every railroad tie. As wage-depressing competitors for jobs, the Irish were hated by native workers. No Irish need apply was a sign commonly posted on factory gate and was often abbreviated to Nina. The Irish, for similar reasons, fiercely resented the blacks with whom they shared society's basement. Race riots between black and Irish dock workers flared up in several port cities, and the Irish were generally cool to the abolitionist cause. The friendless famine Irish were forced to fend for themselves. The ancient order of Hibernarians, a semi-secret society founded in Ireland to fight rapacious landlords, served in America as a benevolent society, aiding the downtrodden. It also helped spawn the Molly Maguires, a shadowy Irish miners union that rocked Pennsylvania coal districts in the 1860s and 1870s. The Irish remained in low-skill occupations, but gradually improved their lot, usually by acquiring modest amounts of property. The education of children was cut short as families struggled to save money to purchase a home. But for humble Irish peasants, cruelly cast out of their homeland, property ownership counted as a grand success. Politics quickly attracted these gregarious Gaelic newcomers. They soon began to gain control of powerful city machines, notably New York's Tammany Hall, and reaped the patronage rewards. Before long, beguiling brogue Irishmen dominated police departments in many big cities, where they now drove the paddy wagons that had once carted their brawling forebears to jail. American politicians made haste to cultivate the Irish vote, especially in the politically potent state of New York. Irish hatred of the British lost nothing in the transatlantic transplanting. As the Irish Americans increased in number, nearly 2 million arrived between 1830 and 1860, officials in Washington glimpsed the political gold in these emerald green hills. Politicians often found it politically profitable to fire verbal volleys at London, a process vulgarly known as twisting the British lion's tail. The German 48ers. The influx of refugees from Germany between 1830 and 1860s was hardly less spectacular than that from Ireland. During these troubled years, over 1.5 million Germans stepped onto the American soil. The bulk of them were uprooted farmers, displaced by crop failures and other hardships, but a strong sprinkling were liberal political refugees. Saddened by the collapse of the democratic revolutions of 1848, remember from World History last year, they had decided to leave the autocratic fatherland to flee America. Or flee to America, the brightest hope for democracy. Germany's loss was America's gain. Zealous German liberals like lanky and public-spirited Karl Schurz, a relentless foe of slavery and public corruption, contributed richly to the elevation of American political life. Unlike the Irish, many of the Germanic newcomers possessed a modest amount of material goods. Most of them pushed out of the lush lands of the Middle West, out to the Midwest, notably Wisconsin, where they settled and established model farms. Like the Irish, they formed an influential body of voters whom American politicians shamelessly wooed. But the Germans were less potent politically because their strength was more widely scattered. The hand of Germans in shaping American life was still felt in other ways. The Conestoga wagon, the Kentucky rifle, and the Christmas tree were all German contributions to American culture. Germans had fled from the militarism and wars of Europe and consequently came to be a bulwark of isolationist sentiment in the upper Mississippi Valley. Better educated on the whole than the stump-grubbing Americans, they warmly supported public schools, including their kindergarten, children's garden. They likewise did much to stimulate art and music, and as outspoken champions of freedom, they became restless enemies of slavery during the fevered years before the Civil War. Yet, the Germans, often dubbed damned Dutchmen, were occasionally regarded with suspicion by their old stock American neighbors. Seeking to preserve their language and culture, they sometimes settled in compact colonies and kept aloof from the surrounding community. Accustomed to the continental Sunday and uncurbed by Puritan tradition, they made merry on the Sabbath and drank huge quantities of amber beverage called beer, which dates its popularity in America to their coming. Their old-world drinking habits, like those of the Irish, spurred advocates of temperance in the use of alcohol and they caused them to redouble their reform efforts. Flare-ups of anti-foreignism. The invasion by this so-called immigrant rabble in the 1840s and 1850s inflamed the prejudices of American nativists, quote-unquote. They feared that these foreign hordes would outbreed, outvote, and overwhelm the old, quote, native stock. Not only did the newcomers take jobs from Native Americans, quote-unquote Native Americans, but the bulk of the displaced Irish were Roman Catholics, as were a substantial minority of the Germans. The Church of Rome was still widely regarded by many old line Americans as foreign, a foreign church. Convents were commonly referred to as popish brothels. Roman Catholics were now on the move. Seeking to protect their children from Protestant indoctrination in public schools, they began in the 1840s to construct an entirely separate Catholic educational system, an enormously expensive undertaking for a poor immigrant community, but one that revealed the strength of its religious commitment. They had formed a negligible minority in the colonial days, and their numbers had increased gradually. But with the enormous influx of the Irish and Germans in the 1840s and 1850s, the Catholics became a powerful religious group. In 1840, they had ranked fifth behind Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists. By 1850, with some 1.8 million communicants, they had bounded into first place, a position they have never lost. Older stock Americans were alarmed by these mounting figures. They professed to believe that, in due time, the alien riffraff would establish the Catholic Church at the expense of the Protestantism and would introduce popish idols. The noisier American nativists rallied for political action. In 1849, they formed the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, which soon developed into a formidable American or Know-Nothing Party, a name derived from its secretiveness. Nativists agitated for rigid restrictions on immigration and naturalization and for laws authorizing the deportation of alien poor people. They also promoted a lurid literature of exposure, much of it pure fiction, what we would call fake news today. The authors, sometimes posing as escaped nuns, described the shocking sins they imagined the cloisters concealed, including a secret burial of babies. One of the sensational books, Maria Monk's Awful Disclosures, sold over 300,000 copies. Even uglier was the occasional mass violence. As early as 1834, a Catholic convent near Boston was burned by a howling mob, and in ensuing years, a few scattered attacks fell upon Catholic schools and churches. The most frightful flare-up occurred during 1844 in Philadelphia, where the Irish Catholics fought back against the threats of the nativists. The city of brotherly love did not quiet down until two Catholic churches had been burned, and some 13 citizens had been killed and 50 wounded in several days of fighting. These outbursts of intolerance, though infrequently and generally localized in larger cities, remain an unfortunate blot on the record of America's treatment of minority groups. Immigrants were undeniably making America a more pluralistic society, one of the most ethnically and racially varied in the history of the world, and perhaps it was a small wonder that cultural clashes would occur. Why, in fact, were such episodes not even more frequent and more violent? Part of the answer lies in the robustness of the American economy. The vigorous growth of the economy in these years both attracted immigrants in the first place and ensured that, once arrived, they could claim their share of the American wealth without jeopardizing the wealth of others. Their hands and brains, in fact, helped fuel economic expansion. Immigrants and the American economy, in short, needed one another. Without the newcomers, a predominantly agricultural West, the United States might well have been condemned to watch in envy as the Industrial Revolution swept through the 19th century Europe. The March of Mechanization. A group of gifted British investors, beginning about 1750, perfected a series of machines for the mass production of textiles. This enslavement of steam multiplied the power of human muscles some 10,000-fold and ushered in the modern factory system, and with it, so-called Industrial Revolution. It was accompanied by a no less spectacular transformation in agricultural production and in the methods of the transportation and communication. The factory system gradually spread from Britain, the world's workshop, to other lands. It took a generation or so to reach Western Europe and then the United States. Why was the youthful American Republic, destined to be an industrial giant, so slow to embrace the machine? For one thing, virgin soil in America was cheap. Landstarved descendants of landstarved peasants were not going to coop themselves up in smelly factories when they might fill their own acres in God's fresh air and sunlight. Labor was therefore generally scarce, and enough nimble hands to operate the machines were hard to find until immigrants began to pour ashore in the 1840s. Money for capital investment, moreover, was not plentiful in pioneering America. Raw materials lay undeveloped, undiscovered, or unsuspected. The Republic was one day to become the world's leading coal producer, but much of the coal burned in colonial times was imported all the way from Britain. Just as labor was scarce, so were consumers. The young country at first lacked a domestic market large enough to make factory-scale manufacturing profitable. Long-established British factories, which provided the cutthroat competition, posed another problem. Their superiority was attested by the fact that a few unscrupulous Yankee manufacturers, out to make a dishonest dollar, stamped their own products with fake English trademarks. The British also enjoyed a monopoly of machinery whose secrets they were anxious to hide from the foreign competitors. Parliament enacted laws, in harmony with the mercantile system, forbidding the export of the machines or the emigration of mechanics able to reproduce them. Although a number of small manufacturing enterprises existed in the early Republic, the future industrial colossus was still snoring. Not until well past the middle of the 19th century did the value of the output of the factories exceed that of the farm. Whitney ends the fiber famine. Samuel Slater has been claimed the father of the factory system in America, and seldom can the paternity of a movement be more properly ascribed to one person. A skilled British mechanic of 21, he was attracted to bounties being offered to British workers familiar with the textile machines. After memorizing the plans for the machinery, he escaped in disguise to America, where he won the backing of Moses Brown, a Quaker capitalist in Rhode Island. Laboriously reconstructing the essential apparatus with the aid of a blacksmith and a carpenter, he put it into operation in 1791, the first efficient American machinery for spinning cotton thread. The ravenous mechanism was now ready, but where was the cotton fiber? Handpicking 1 pound of lint from 3 pounds of seed was a full day's work for one slave, and this process was so expensive that cotton cloth was relatively rare. Another mechanical genius, Massachusetts-born Eli Whitney, now made his mark. After graduating from Yale, he journeyed to Georgia to serve as a private tutor while preparing for the law. There he was told that the poverty of the South would be relieved if someone could only invent a workable device for separating the seed from the short staple cotton fiber. Within 10 days, in 1793, he built a crude machine called the cotton gin, short for N-gin, that was 50 times more effective than the hand-picking process. Few machines have ever wrought so wondrous a change. The gin affected not only the history of America, but that of the world. Almost overnight, the raising of cotton became highly profitable, and the South was tied hand and foot to the throne of King Cotton. Human bondage had been dying out, but the insatiable demand for cotton riveted the chains on the limbs of the downtrodden Southern blacks. It made it worse. South and North both prospered. Slave-driving planters cleared more acres for cotton, pushing the cotton kingdom westward off the depleted Tidewater plains, over the Piedmont, and onto the Black Loam bottomlands of Alabama and Mississippi. Humming gins poured out avalanches of snowy fiber for the spindles of the Yankee machines, though for decades to come, the mills of Britain bought the lion's share of Southern cotton. The American phase of the Industrial Revolution, which first blossomed in cotton textiles, was well on its way. Factories at first flourished most actively in New England, though they branched out into the more populous areas of New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. South, increasingly wedded to the production of cotton, could boast comparatively little manufacturing. Its capital was bound up in slaves. Its local consumers, for the most part, were desperately poor. New England was singularly favored as an industrial center for several reasons. Its narrow belt of stony soil discouraged farming and hence made manufacturing more attractive than elsewhere. A relatively dense population provided labor and accessible markets. Shipping brought in capital, and snug seaports made easy the import of raw materials and the export of the finished products. Finally, the rapid rivers, notably the Merrimack in Massachusetts, provided the abundant water power to turn the cogs of the machines. By 1860, more than 400 million pounds of Southern cotton poured annually into the gaping maws of over 1,000 mills, mostly in New England. Marvels of manufacturing. America's factories spread slowly until about 1807, when there began the fateful sequence of the embargo, non-intercourse, and the War of 1812. Stern necessity dictated the manufacture of substitutes for normal imports, while the stoppage of European commerce was temporarily ruinous to Yankee shipping. Both capital and labor were driven from the waves onto the factory floor, as New England, in the striking phrase of John Randolph, exchanged the trident for the distaff, the factory. Generous bounties were offered by local authorities for homegrown goods. Buy American and wear American became popular slogans, and patriotism prompted the wearing of baggy, homespun garments. President Madison donned some at his inauguration, where he was said to have been walking argument for the better processing of native wool. But the manufacturing boomlet broke abruptly with the Peace of Ghent in 1815, that ended the War of 1812. British competitors unloaded their dammed-up surpluses at ruinously low prices, and American newspapers were so full of British advertisements for goods on credit that little space was left for news. In one Rhode Island district, all 150 mills were forced to close their doors except the original Slater plant. Responding to pained outcries, Congress provided some relief when it passed the mildly protective tariff of 1816. American system, Henry Clay, right? Tariff of 1816. Among the earliest political contests to control the shape of the economy. As the factory system flourished, it embraced numerous other industries, in addition to textiles. Prominent among them was the manufacturing of firearms, and here the wizardly Eli Whitney again appeared with an extraordinary contribution. Frustrated in his earlier efforts to monopolize the cotton gin, he turned to the mass production of muskets for the U.S. Army. Up to this time, each part of a firearm had been hand-tooled, and if the trigger of one broke, the trigger of another might or might not fit. About 1798, Whitney seized upon the idea of having machines make each part so that all the triggers, for example, would be as much alike as the successive imprints of a copperplate engraving. Journeying to Washington, he reportedly dismantled 10 of his new muskets in the presence of skeptical officials, scrambled the parts together, and then quickly reassembled 10 different muskets. The principle of interchangeable parts was widely adopted by 1850, and it ultimately became the basis of modern mass production. Assembly line methods. It gave to the North the vast industrial plant that ensured military preponderance over the South. Ironically, the Yankee Eli Whitney, by perfecting the cotton gin, gave slavery a renewed lease on life, and perhaps made inevitable the Civil War. At the same time, by popularizing the principle of interchangeable parts, Whitney helped factories to flourish in the North, giving the Union a decided advantage when the showdown came. The sawing machine, invented by Elias Howe in 1846 and perfected by Isaac Singer, gave another strong boost to northern industrialization. The sawing machine became the foundation of the ready-made clothing industry, which took root about the same time of the Civil War. It drove many a seamstress from the shelter of the private home to the factory where, like a human robot, she tended to the clattering mechanisms. Each momentous new invention seemed to stimulate still more imaginative inventions. For the decade ending in 1800, only 306 patents were registered in Washington, but the decade ending in 1860 saw the amazing total of 28,000. Yet, in 1838, the clerk of the patent office had resigned in despair, complaining that all worthwhile inventions had already been discovered. Technical advances spurred equally important changes in the form of legal status of business organizations. We're looking at business organizations here. The principle of limited liability aided the concentration of capital by permitting the individual investor, in cases of legal claims or bankruptcy, to risk no more than his own share of the corporation's stock. 15 Boston families formed one of the earliest investment capital companies, the Boston Associates. They eventually dominated the textile, railroad, insurance, and banking industries of Massachusetts. Laws of, quote, free incorporation, first passed in New York in 1848, meant that businessmen could create corporations without applying it for individual charters from the legislature. Samuel F.B. Morse's telegraph was among the inventions that tightened the sinews of an increasingly complex business world. A distinguished but poverty-stricken portrait painter, Morse finally secured from Congress, the accompaniment of the usual jeers, an appropriation of $30,000 to support his experiment with clocking wires. In 1844, Morse strung a wire 40 miles from Washington to Baltimore and tapped out the historic message, "What has God wrought?" The invention brought fame and fortune to Morse as he put distantly separated people in almost instant communication with one another. By the eve of the Civil War, a web of singing wires spanned the continent, revolutionizing news gathering, diplomacy, and finance. Workers and, quote, wage slaves. One ugly outgrowth of the factory system was an increasingly acute labor problem. Hitherto, manufacturing had been done in the home or in the small shop where the master craftsman and his apprentice, rubbing elbows at the same bench, could maintain an intimate and friendly relationship. The Industrial Revolution submerged this personal association in the impersonal ownership of stuffy factories in spindle cities. Around these, like tumors, the slum-like hovels of the wage slaves tended to cluster. Clearly, the early factory system did not shower its benefits evenly on all. While many owners waxed fat, working people often wasted away at their workbenches. Hours were long, wages were low, and meals were skimpy and hastily gulped. Workers were forced to toil in unsanitary buildings that were poorly ventilated, lighted, and heated. They were forbidden by law to form labor unions to raise wages, for such cooperative activity was regarded as a criminal conspiracy. Not surprisingly, only 24 recorded strikes occurred before 1835. Especially vulnerable to exploitation were child workers. In 1820, half the nation's industrial toilers were children under the ages of 10. Victims of factory labor, many children were mentally blighted, emotionally starved, physically stunted, and even brutally whipped in special whipping rooms. In Samuel Slater's mill of 1791, the first machine tenders were 7 boys and 2 girls, all under 12 years of age. By contrast, the lot of most adult wage workers improved markedly in the 1820s and 1830s. In the full flush of Jacksonian democracy, many of the states granted the laboring man the vote. Brandishing the ballot, he first strove to lighten his burden through working man's parties. Eventually, many workers gave their loyalty to the Democratic Party of Andrew Jackson. The attack on the Bank of the United States and against all form of privilege reflected their anxieties about the emerging capitalist economy. In addition to such goals as a 10-hour day, higher wages, and tolerable working conditions, they demanded public education for their children and an end to the inhuman practice of imprisonment for debt. Employers, abhorring the rise of the rabble in politics, fought the 10-hour day to the last ditch. They argued that reduced hours would lessen production, increase cost, and demoralize the workers. Laborers would have so much leisure time that the devil would lead them into mischief. A red letter gain was at length registered for labor in 1840 when President Van Buren established a 10-hour workday for federal employees on public works. In ensuing years, a number of states gradually fell into line by reducing the hours of working people. Day laborers at last learned that their strongest weapon was to lay down their tools, even at the risk of persecution under the law. Prosecution. Dozens of strikes erupted in the 1830s and 1840s, most of them for higher wages, some for the 10-hour day, and a few such unusual goals as the right to smoke on the job. Workers usually lost more strikes than they won, but the employer could resort to such tactics as the importing of strike breakers, often derisively called scabs or rats, and often fresh off the boat from the old world. Labor long raised its voice against the unrestricted importing of wage-depressing and union-busting immigrant workers. Labor's early and painful efforts at organization had netted some 300,000 trade unionists by 1830, but such encouraging gains were dashed on the rocks of hard times following the severe depression of 1837. The Panic of 1837, remember some of you argued it was Jackson's fault, others said it was a worldwide issue. This hit the workers hard. As unemployment spread, union membership tripled. Yet toilers won a promising legal victory in 1842. The Supreme Court of Massachusetts ruled in the state of Commonwealth versus Hunt that labor unions were not illegal conspiracies, provided that their methods were, quote, honorable and peaceful. This enlightened decision did not legalize the strike overnight throughout the country, but it was a significant signpost of the times. Trade unions still had a rocky road to hoe, stretching ahead for about a century before they could meet management on relatively even terms. Women and the economy. Women were also sucked into the clanging mechanism of factory production. Farm women and girls had an important place in the pre-industrial economy, spinning yarn, weaving cloth, and making candles, soap, butter, and cheese. New factories, such as the textile mills of New England, undermined these activities, cranking out manufactured goods much faster than they could be made by hand at home. Yet these same factories offered employment to the very young women whose work they were displacing. Factory jobs promised greater economic independence for women, as well as the means to buy the manufactured products of the new market economy. Factory girls typically toiled 6 days a week, earning a pittance for dreary, limb-numbing, ear-splitting stints of 12 or 13 hours from dark to dark. The Boston Associates, nonetheless, proudly pointed to their textile mill in Lowell, Massachusetts, as a showplace factory. The workers were virtually all New England farm girls, carefully supervised on and off the job by watchful matrons. Escorted regularly to church from their company boarding houses and forbidden to form unions, they had few opportunities to share dissatisfaction over their grueling working conditions. But factory jobs of any kind were still unusual for women. Opportunities for women
to be economically self-supporting were scarce and consisted mainly of nursing, domestic service, and especially teaching. Dedicated Catherine Beecher, unmarried daughter of a famous preacher and sister of Harriet Beecher Stowe, tirelessly urged women to enter the teaching profession. She eventually succeeded beyond her dreams as men left teaching for other lines of work and school teaching became a thoroughly feminized occupation. Other work opportunities for women beckoned in household service. Perhaps one white family in 10 employed servants at mid-century, most of whom were poor white immigrant or black women. About 10% of white women were working for pay outside their homes, their own, in 1850. Estimates are that about 20% of all women had been employed at some time prior to marriage. The vast majority of working men were single. The vast majority of working women were single. Upon marriage, they left their paying jobs and took up their new work, without wages, as wives and mothers. In the home, they were enshrined in a cult of domesticity, a widespread cultural creed that glorified the customary functions of the homemaker. From their pedestal, married women commanded immense moral power, and they increasingly made decisions that altered the character of the family itself. Women's changing roles in the spreading Industrial Revolution brought some important changes in the life of the 19th century home, the traditional, quote, women's sphere. Love, not parental arrangement, more and more frequently determined the choice of a spouse, yet parents often retained the power of veto. Families thus became more closely knit and affectionate, providing the emotional refuge that made the threatening impersonality of big city industrialism tolerable to many people. They could take the big city, the industries, because at least home they had someone they loved and cared about. Most striking, families grew smaller. The average household had nearly 6 members at the end of the 18th century, with fewer than 5 members a century later. The fertility rate, or number of births among women aged 14 to 45, sharply dropped among white women in the years after the Revolution, and in the course of the 19th century as a whole, fell by half. Birth control was still a taboo topic for white conversation, and contraceptive technology was primitive, but clearly some form of family limitation was being practiced quietly and effectively in countless families, rural and urban alike. Women undoubtedly played a large part, perhaps the leading part, in decisions to have fewer children. This newly assertive role for women has often been called domestic feminism, because it signified the growing power and the independence of women, even while they remained wrapped in a cult of domesticity. Smaller families, in turn, meant child-centered families, since where children are fewer, parents can lavish more care on them individually. European visitors to the U.S. in the 19th century often complained about the unruly behavior of American brats, but though American parents may have increasingly spared the rod, they did not spoil their children. Lessons were enforced by punishments other than the hickory stick. When the daughter of novelist Henry Beecher Stowe neglected to do her homework, her mother sent her from the dinner table and gave her, quote, only bread and water in her own apartment. What Europeans saw as permissiveness was in reality the consequence of an emerging new idea of childbearing, in which the child's will was not simply to be broken, but rather shaped. In the little republic of the family, as in the republic at large, good citizens were not to be meekly obedient to authority, but to be independent individuals who could make their own decisions on the basis of internalized moral standards. Thus, the outlines of the modern family were clear by mid-century. It was small, affectionate, and child-centered, and it provided a special arena for the talents of women. Feminists of a later day might decry the stifling atmosphere of the 19th century home, but to many women at the time, it seemed a big step upward from the conditions of grinding toil, often alongside men in the fields in which their mothers had lived.
Western farmers reap a revolution in the fields. As smoke-belching factories altered the eastern skyline, flourishing farms were changing the face of the West. The Trans-Allegheny region, especially the Ohio, Indiana, Illinois tier, was fast becoming the nation's breadbasket. Before long, it would become the granary to the world. Pioneering families first hacked the clearing out of the forest and then planted their painfully furrowed fields to corn. The yellow grain was amazingly versatile. It could be fed to hogs, corn on the hoof, or distilled into liquor, corn in the bottle. Both these products could be transported more easily than the bulky grain itself, and they became the early Western farmers' staple market items. So many hogs were butchered, traded, or shipped in Cincinnati that the city was known as the Porkopolis of the West. Most Western produce was at first floated down the Ohio-Mississippi River system to feed the lusty appetite of the booming cotton kingdom. But Western farmers were as hungry for profits as Southern slaves and planters were for food.
These tillers, spurred on by the easy availability of seemingly boundless acres, sought ways to bring more and more land into cultivation. Ingenious inventors came to their aid. One of the first obstacles that frustrated the farmers was the thickly matted soil of the West, which snagged and shaped fragile wooden plows. John Deere of Illinois, in 1837, finally produced a steel plow that broke the virgin soil. Sharp and effective, it was also light enough to be pulled by horses rather than oxen. In the 1830s, Virginia-born Cyrus McCormick contributed the most wondrous contraption of all, a mechanical mower reaper. The clattering cogs of McCormick's horse-drawn machine were to the Western farmers what the cotton gin was to the Southern planters. Seated on his red chariot reaper, a single husbandman could do the work of five men with sickles and scythes. No other American invention cut so wide a swath. It made ambitious capitalists out of humble plowmen, who now scrambled for more acres on which to plant more fields of billowing wheat. Subsistence farming gave way to the production for the market, as large-scale, extensive, specialized cash crop agriculture came to dominate the trans-Allegheny West. With it followed mounting indebtedness as farmers bought more and more land and more machinery to work it. Soon, hustling farm and business people were annually harvesting a larger crop in the South, which was becoming self-sufficient in food production to devour. They began to dream of markets elsewhere, in the mushrooming factory towns of the East or across the faraway Atlantic. But they were still largely landlocked. Commerce moved north and south on the river system, but it could begin to move east-west in bulk. Before it could move west and east, it had to be a transportation revolution would have to occur. So the highway transportation system, highways and steamboats. Highways and steamboats. In 1789, when the Constitution was launched, primitive methods of travel were still in use. Waterborne commerce, whether along the coast or on rivers, was slow, uncertain, and often dangerous. Stagecoaches and wagons lurched over bone-shaking roads. Passengers would be routed out to lay nearby fence rails along muddy stretches, and occasionally horses would be drawn into muddy pits where the wagon sank slowly out of sight. And I'm going to pause for a minute to build my son's train track. Cheap and efficient carriers were imperative if raw materials were to be transported to factories and if finished products were to be delivered to consumers. On December 3, 1803, a firm in Providence, Rhode Island, sent a shipment of yarn to a point 60 miles away, notifying the purchaser that the consignment could be expected to arrive in the, quote, course of the winter. A promising improvement came in the 1790s when a private company completed the Lancaster Turnpike in Pennsylvania. It was a broad, hard-surfaced highway that thrust 62 miles westward from Philadelphia to Lancaster. As drivers approached the toll gate, they were confronted with a barrier of sharp pikes, which were turned aside when they paid their toll, hence the term turnpike. The Lancaster Turnpike proved to be a highly successful venture, returning as high as 15% annual dividends to its stockholders. It attracted a rich trade to Philadelphia and touched off a turnpike building boom that lasted about 20 years. It also stimulated Western development. The turnpikes beckoned to the canvas-covered Conestoga wagons, whose creakings heralded a westward advance that would know no real retreat. Western road building, always expensive, encouraged many obstacles. One pesky roadblock was the noisy states' riders who opposed federal aid to local projects. Eastern states also protested against being bled of their populations by the westward-reaching arteries. Westerners scored a notable triumph in 1811 when the federal government began to construct the elongated National Road, or Cumberland Road. This highway ultimately stretched from Cumberland in western Maryland to Vandalia in Illinois, a distance of 591 miles. The War of 1812 interrupted construction, and states' rights shackles on the internal improvements hampered federal grants. But the thoroughfare was belatedly brought to its destination in 1852 by a combination of aid from the states and the federal government. The steamboat craze, which overlapped the turnpike craze, was touched off by an ambitious painter-engineer named Robert Fulton. He installed a powerful steam engine in a vessel that posterity came to know as the Clermont, but that a dubious public dubbed Fulton's Folly. On an historic day in 1807, the quaint little ship, belching sparks from its single smokestack, churned steadily from New York City up the Hudson River towards Albany. It made the run of 150 miles in 32 hours. Note today that takes about 2 hours. The success of the steamboat was sensational. People can now in large degree defy wind, wave, tide, and downstream current. With a few years, Fulton had changed all of America's navigable waterways into two-way arteries, thereby doubling their carrying capacity. Hitherto, keelboats had been pushed up the Mississippi with quivering poles and rankest profanity at less than 1 mile an hour. a process that was prohibitively expensive. Now, the steamboats could churn rapidly against the current, ultimately attaining speeds in excess of 10 miles an hour. The mighty Mississippi had met its master. Take that. By 1820, there were some 60 steamboats on the Mississippi and its tributaries. By 1860, about 1,000, some of them luxurious river palaces. Keen rivalry among the swift and gaudy steamers led to memorable races. Excited passengers would urge the captain to pile on more wood at the risk of bursting the boilers, which all too often exploded with tragic results for the floating fire traps. Chugging steamboats played a vital role in the opening of the West and the South, both of which were richly endowed with navigable rivers. Like bunches of grapes on a vine, population clustered along the banks of the broad flowing streams. Cotton growers and other farmers made haste to take up and turn over the now profitable virgin soil. Not only could they float their produce out to market, but hardly less important, they could ship it at a low cost, their shoes, hardware, and other manufacturers. So they could ship out stuff to other markets, and they can get stuff from eastern markets. This creates an internal market and ties together our market economy. Clinton's Big Ditch in New York. A canal cutting craze paralleled the boom in turnpikes and steamboats. A few canals had been built around falls and elsewhere in colonial days, but ambitious projects lay in the future. Resourceful New Yorkers, cut off from the federal aid by states' riders, themselves dug the Erie Canal, linking the Great Lakes with the Hudson River. They were blessed with the driving leadership of Governor DeWitt Clinton, whose grandiose projects was scoffingly called Clinton's Big Ditch or the Governor's Gutter. Begun in 1817, the canal eventually ribboned 363 miles. On its completion in 1825, a garland canal boat glided from Buffalo on Lake Erie to the Hudson River and onto the New York Harbor. There, with colorful ceremony, Governor Clinton emptied a cask of water from the lake to symbolize the marriage of the waters. The water from Clinton's keg baptized the Empire State. Mule-drawn passengers and bulky freight could now be handled with thrift and dispatch at the dizzying speed of 5 miles an hour. The cost of shipping a ton of grain from Buffalo to New York City fell from $100 to $5, and the time of transit from about 20 days to 6. Ever-widening economic ripples followed the completion of the Erie Canal. The value of land along the route skyrocketed, and new cities such as Rochester and Syracuse blossomed. Industry in the state boomed. The new profitability of farming in the Old Northwest, notably in Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, and Illinois, attracted thousands of European immigrants to the unaxed and untaxed lands now available. Flotillas of steamships soon plied the Great Lakes, connecting with canal barges in Buffalo. Interior waterside villages like Cleveland, Detroit, and Chicago exploded into mighty cities. Other profound economic and political changes followed the canal's completion. The price of potatoes in New York City was cut in half, and many dispirited New England farmers, no longer able to face the ruinous competition, abandoned their rocky holdings and went elsewhere. Some became millhands, thus speeding up the industrialization of America. Others, finding it easy to go west and over the Erie Canal, took up new farmland south of the Great Lakes, where they were joined by thousands of New Yorkers and other Northerners. Still others shifted to fruit, vegetable, and dairy farming. The transformations in the Northeast canal consequences showed how long-established local market structures could be swamped by the emerging behemoth of a continental market economy. All right, now we're back. My son is working on his own transportation network in the house right now. Let's go to the iron horse. The most significant contribution to the development of such an economy proved to be the railroad. It was fast, reliable, cheaper than the canals to construct, and not frozen over in the winter. Able to go almost anywhere, even through the Allegheny Barrier, it defied terrain and weather. The first railroad appeared in the United States in 1828. By 1860, only 32 years later, the United States boasted 30,000 miles of railroad track, three-fourths of it in the rapidly industrializing North. At first, the railroad faced strong opposition from vested interests, especially canal backers. Anxious to protect its investment in the Erie Canal, the New York legislature in 1833 prohibited the railroads from carrying freight, at least temporarily. Early railroads were also considered a dangerous public menace, for flying sparks could set off fire to nearby haystacks and houses. And appalling railroad accidents could turn the wooden miniature hells into flaming funeral pyres for their riders. Yikes. Railroad pioneers had to overcome other obstacles as well. Brakes were so feeble that the engineer might miss the station twice, both arriving and backing up.
Arrival and departures were conjectural, and numerous differences in gauge, the distance between the rails, meant frequent changes of trains for passengers. In 1840, there were 7 transfers between Philadelphia and Charleston, but gauges gradually became standardized. Better brakes did break, safety devices were adopted, and the Pullman Sleeping Palace was introduced in 1859. America, at long last, was being bound together by the braces of iron, later to be made of steel. Cables, clippers, and pony riders. Other forms of transportation and communication were binding together the United States and the world. A crucial development came in 1858 when Cyrus Field, called the greatest wire puller in history, finally stretched a cable under the deep North Atlantic waters from Newfoundland to Ireland. Although this initial cable went dead after 3 weeks of public rejoicing, a heavier cable laid in 1866 permanently linked the American and European continents. The United States Merchant Marine encountered rough sailing during much of the early 19th century. American vessels had been repeatedly laid up by the embargo, the War of 1812, and the panics of 1819 and 1837. American naval designers made few contributions to maritime progress. A pioneer American steamer, the Savannah, had crept across the Atlantic in 1819, but used sail most of the time and was pursued for a day by a British captain who thought it was a fire. In the 1840s and 1850s, a golden age dawned for American shipping. Yankee naval yards, notably Donald McKay's at Boston, began to send down the ways sleek new craft called clipper ships. Long, narrow, and majestic, they glided across the sea under towering masts and clouds of canvas. In a fair breeze, they could outrun a steamer. The stately clippers sacrificed cargo space for speed, and their captains made killings by hauling high-value cargoes in record times. They arrested much of the tea-carrying trade between the Far East and Britain from their slow-sailing British competitors, and they sped thousands of impatient adventurers to the gold fields of California and Australia. But the hour of glory for the clipper was relatively brief. On the eve of the Civil War, the British had clearly won the world race for maritime ascendancy with their iron tramp steamers, tea kettles. Although slower and less romantic than the clipper, these vessels were steadier, roomier, more reliable, and hence more profitable. No story of rapid American communication would be complete without including the Far West. By 1858, horse-drawn overland stagecoaches, immortalized by Mark Twain's Roughing It, were a familiar sight. Boats are good, right? The dusty tracks stretched from the bank of the muddy Missouri River clear to California. Even more dramatic was the Pony Express, established in 1860 to carry mail speedily to 2,000 lonely miles from St. Joseph, Missouri to Sacramento, California. Daring, lightweight riders leaping onto wiry ponies, saddled at stations approximately 10 miles apart, could make the trip in an amazing 10 days. These unarmed horsemen galloped on, summer or winter, day or night, through dust or snow, past Indians and bandits. The speeding postman missed only one trip, though the whole enterprise lost money heavily and folded after only 18 legendary leaving months. Just as the clippers had succumbed to steam, so were the express riders unhorsed by Samuel Morse's clacking keys, which began tapping messages to California in 1861. The swift ships and the fleet ponies ushered out the dying technology of wind and muscle. In the future, machines would be on the saddle. More than anything else, the desire of the East to tap the West stimulated the transportation revolution. Until about 1830, the produce of the western region drained southward to the cotton belt or to the heaped-up wharves in New Orleans. The steamboat vastly aided the reverse flow of finished goods up the watery western arteries and helped bind west and south together. But the truly revolutionary changes in commerce and communication came in the 3 decades before the Civil War, as canals and railroad tracks radiated out from the east across the Alleghenies and into the blossoming heartland. The ditch diggers and tie layers were attempting nothing less than the conquest of nature itself. They would offset the natural flow of trade on the interior rivers by laying down an impressive grid of internal improvements. The builders succeeded beyond their wildest dreams. The Mississippi was increasingly robbed of its traffic as goods moved eastward on trucking trains, puffing lake bulks, and mule-tugged canal barges. Governor Clinton had, in effect, picked up the mighty father of waters and flung it over the Alleghenies, forcing it to empty into the sea at New York City. By the 1840s, the city of Buffalo handled more western produce than New Orleans. Between 1836 and 1860, grain shipments through Buffalo increased a staggering 60-fold. New York City became the seaboard queen of the nation, a gigantic port through which a vast hinterland poured its wealth and to which its daily paid economic tribute. By the eve of the Civil War, a truly continental economy had emerged. The principle of division of labor, which spelled productivity and profits in the factory, applied on a national scale as well. Each region now specialized in a particular type of economic activity. The South raised cotton for cotton export to New England and Britain. The West grew grain and livestock to feed factory workers in the East and in Europe. The East made machines and textiles for the South and the West. The economic pattern thus woven had fateful political and military implications. Many Southerners regarded the Mississippi as a silver chain that naturally linked the Upper Valley states and the Cotton Kingdom. They were convinced, as secession approached, that some or all of these states would have to secede with them or be strangled. But they overlooked the man-made links that now bound the Upper Mississippi Valley to the East in an intimate commercial union. Southern rebels would have to fight not only Northern armies, but the tight bonds of an interdependent continental economy. Economically, the two northerly sections were Siamese twins. The market revolution. No less revolutionary than the principal political upheavals of the antebellum era was the market revolution that transformed a subsistence economy of scattered farms and tiny workshops into a national network of industry and commerce. As more and more Americans, mill workers as well as farmhands, women as well as men, linked their economic fate to the burgeoning market economy, the self-sufficient households of colonial days were transformed. Most families had once raised all of their own food, spun their own wool, and bartered with their neighbors for a few necessities they could not make themselves. In growing numbers, they now scattered to work for wages in the mills, or they planted just a few crops for sale at market and used the money to buy goods made by strangers in far-off factories. As store-bought fabrics, candles, and soap replaced homemade products, a quiet revolution occurred in the household division of labor and status. Traditional women's work was rendered superfluous and devalued. The home itself, once the center of economic production in which all family members cooperated, grew into a place of refuge from the world of work, a refuge that was becoming increasingly the special and separate sphere of women. Revolutionary advances in manufacturing and transportation brought increased prosperity to all Americans, but they also widened the gulf between rich and the poor. Millionaires had been rare in the early days of the Republic, but by the eve of the Civil War, several specimens of colossal financial success were strutting across the national stage. Spectacular was the case of the fur trader and real estate speculator John Jacob Astor, who left an estate of $30 million on his death in 1848. Cities bred the greatest extremes of economic inequality. Unskilled workers, then as always, fared the worst. Many of them came to make up the floating mass of drifters, buffeted from town to town by the shifting prospects of menial jobs. These wandering workers accounted at various times for up to half the population of the brawling industrial centers. Although their numbers were large, they left little behind them but the homely fruits of their transient labor. Largely unstoried and unsung, they are amongst the forgotten men and women of American history. Many myths about social mobility grew up over the buried memories of these unfortunate day laborers. Mobility did exist in industrializing America, but not in the proportions that legend often portrays. Rags-to-riches success stories were relatively few. Yet America, with its dynamic society and wide open spaces, undoubtedly provided more opportunity than did the contemporary countries of the Old World, which is why millions of immigrants packed their bags and headed for the New World shores. Moreover, a rising tide lifts all boats, and the improvement in overall standards of living was real. Wages for unskilled workers in a land-hungry America rose about 1% a year from 1820 to 1860. This general prosperity helped defuse the potential class conflict that might otherwise have exploded, and that did explode in many European countries. Shazam!